see how that works. If you were to plot that, you'd see that as you start to do it, your mind is going all over the place, around it, and associative things, and then slowly, over time, it just gets, quiets down until it goes deeper in. It's like penetration into the universe through one repetitive thing, whether it's breath or mantra. And when you get into a study of mantras, you see the different mantras take you into different kinds of spaces. Some mantras, that one takes you beyond form. It's designed to keep taking you out, out. Gate, gate, swaha. There are mantras that are very much like power mantras that take you into Om Hung Vajra Guru Padme Siddhi Hung Aum Hung Vajra Guru Padme Siddhi Hung. You do that for about 2 days, and you're like, it's like, you know. Or, like I do Shri Ram, Shri Ram, Shri Ram, Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai 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 Ram. That's sweet. I've been doing that for 23 years, I guess. It's gotten in there. Shri Ram, Jai Ram. See, and I have these beads, which are called worry beads or rosary or malas, whatever you want. But they're just techniques for doing that same thing. And these beads are Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram, Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram, Shri Ram, Jai Ram. So when I'm at the supermarket, at the checkout line, see, and there's a woman at the head of the line who's gotten about $150 worth of groceries, and just at the end, the woman says how much it is, and then the other cashier, and then this woman reaches into her pocketbook and brings out her checkbook and starts to fill it out and fill out all the things on the in the checkbook. And we're all waiting, and it's late in the day, and we're all tired, and you get that moment, Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram. Or when you're in traffic, you're driving along and it's all so thick and heavy and real, and the fatigue is heavy and it's all stuff and it's Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram, Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram. It's like sanforizing it. It's like it's ramizing it. It's just converting it all into something else. It's converting it all into what's called lila, or the play of life. Frustrated, great, enjoy it. Boy, am I frustrated. Oh, people come and say I'm bored. I say, is it fun? No, it's not fun, I'm bored. Right, well, try again. Is it fun? What is it like? Is it hot or cold? Well, it's boredom. Well, does it last forever? It's interesting because we take all these things and we treat them as so real. I'm bored, I got to do something. Instead of, I'm bored, wow, let's see what that's like. I think I'll be bored. How do you do? I'm bored. What are you doing? I'm being bored. 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 Boy, am I bored. I'm still bored. Wow, am I bored. God. Oh, is this boring. Nothing's happening. I'm just so bored. God. Still bored. Ram, ram. I'm bored. See, it's like the difference between I'm depressed and there's depression. Boy, look at that depression versus I'm depressed. Because Ram keeps reminding you that behind all the melodrama of life, here we are. Here I is. Just sitting back here. So what you're doing is you're starting to use the events of daily life to see through it, to come in behind it. Like human relations, they are such a rich field of drama, aren't they? Will she, won't she, can I, can't I, should I, shouldn't I, did he then, and then what did he do, and oh my God, no, and oh, can I, oh, I hope, ooh, no, I mean, it's all beautiful, it's beautiful stuff, but how many times around do you have to go? It's just endlessly fascinating. I mean, it's just endlessly fascinating. You don't say. Eh? That's why People Magazine and all that stuff, endlessly fascinating, a kind of voyeurist delight. And after a while, you practice. You practice when you meet people and look, just as you do Ram, looking with another human being through and behind what you're hearing and seeing. Hearing it and seeing it and responding at the same moment. It's what you're doing is learning how to live on more than one plane of consciousness simultaneously. So that you're both a fellow human being involved in relationship and you're also just one with this other thing anyway. So it's really a relationship becomes like a triangle. There's one and then there's two. And the two are doing their dance of two. Do you? Don't I? Yes. But when you're working at it, you're finding the one that lies behind the two. So it's the dance of one as two. You're using two to come into the one, and then as one, you're dancing as two. That's what's known as Tantra in terms of human relationships. It's using the two to come into the one, not to deny the two, but to dance as the two. So that in a marriage, the man and the woman are separate and they're not separate. They are one and they are two. And when they get too caught in their two, it's always separate and subject-object. And when you get too caught in the one, you fail to honor the diversity and the uniqueness, and the difference. One and two, one and two. And you practice, you use your human relationships to do that. And when you get quiet enough inside, you begin to see other people's minds and how thick they are making the stew. And how real it is, because you feel yourself as the object of their projective systems. They come up to you and they say things like, Ram Dass. See? Yes. You know, you can feel how you kind of climb into it. Or they say, hey, Ram. Yeah, you know, I mean, it's far out. And you can feel that when you aren't busy being somebody, you're just here, you feel the thickness of somebody else's projections come at you, and their projection includes who you're supposed to be as well. So somebody that's busy feeling sorry for themselves, they need you in order to reinforce that definition of themselves. So their mind goes out and says, poor me, don't you feel sorry for me? And it's interesting to be there for them without getting trapped in the projections of their minds. That's such an art form. I've told this before, but many years ago in 1968 or 9, a woman came to see me up in New Hampshire in the little cabin I was living in behind my father's house. And she was a local seamstress. And her hands were the hands of a seamstress, and she had raised two daughters. Her husband had left when she was about, the youngest was 6 months old. She had raised the children as a seamstress, being a seamstress. Now her oldest daughter lived in the South, and the youngest one, she told me, had gone to the South to visit the oldest daughter and had forged a check of the oldest daughter's bank account. So she came in, wringing her handkerchief with her hands, sat down and told me this whole story. And it was a poignant story. You know, I've done this for my kids, and now look at how it's turned out. She told the whole story. I mean, it was wrenching. And I listened to it. And she got all done, and I said, and I was just doing my Ram, Ram, Ram to myself, listening. At the end, I said, I hear you. And that didn't satisfy her, because she was used to that story eliciting a certain reaction of you poor dear, or whatever, or that ingrate, or whatever. Or, but you love her anyway, because it's your child. All I said was, I hear you. She said, no, you don't understand. All I said was, I hear you. You don't understand. And she told me the whole story all over again. And I listened again fully. At the end, I said, I hear you. And the funniest thing happened, this little smile at the corner of her mouth. And she said, you know, I was kind of a hellion when I was a kid, too. Now, in this sense, I wasn't punishing her for being in that model, but at the same moment, I wasn't reinforcing the reality of it. So there was space for her to come up for air. Because when you're very persuasive and with your mind, you suck everybody into your reality, and it takes a really strong person to create a space for you to come out of it, as every therapist knows. I mean, when you really feel sorry for yourself, you try to get the whole world to conspire to reinforce how worthy of pity you are. So a lot of the art form of the work is to be there with your heart open and not get sucked in by somebody else's projective systems, and so that you can see behind the veil. Let's take some questions for a little while, and then we'll do another exercise. He said, what do you do when you've been doing a mantra and suddenly you just drift off and you forget you're even doing the mantra? The minute you notice you've drifted, just go back to the mantra. You don't get into, oh, I'm bad, or I screwed up, or because that's just more drifting. Don't even feed it. Just go back to the mantra. Just say, for the next, whatever, 20 minutes, I'm going to do the mantra. And your mind will drift away many times. And every time it drifts, bring it back. And at the first times, the first 5 weeks, I've gotten into, I remember doing meditation where you're just following the breath in my abdomen going up and down. And I would think, all right, I'm going to follow the breath in my abdomen going up and down for the next 40 minutes. And then immediately the thoughts would start, you know, like, what am I doing here? Or this is absurd, or when is lunch, or whatever. And I've gone into places like meditation places in Burma to sit for 2 months, and I sit there looking like I'm meditating. And I've gotten into the place where I start a sexual fantasy, and I for 7 hours, I mean, I just be having the fantasy, you know, and I'd look like I was meditating. And every now and then I'd think, Jesus, I'm supposed to be meditating. Ah, screw it. You know, I'm going to go back to my fantasy. And then finally, since I was there for 2 months, you know, how long can the fantasy go? You get bored after a while. And then I go back to my breath. But so, I mean, I know what resistance is. And you just are very compassionate with yourself. You realize your mind's going to go, because all it's reflecting is the uncooked seeds of desire that you're still identified with. No big deal. Just keep coming back, coming back. Questions. When you are aware, what does it feel like? That's the question. There are two noticeable. See, it's as you say, it's very tricky to even talk about it. There are characteristics that you can note, but they disappear back into it again. But the characteristics you know would be emptiness, and you would notice clarity. Those would be two clear ones. You'd notice absolute, just quiet, empty clarity. You're right here. You're empty. It's all empty form. And the forms are all moving and dancing and doing, including your body, your feelings, your thoughts, all of the thing around you. It's all happening. And you're just sitting here. You're not even sitting here. You just... So there is a quality of this vast spaciousness which embraces everything in itself. It's like I have a guru. He had a body, which he left in 1973. And he's the most constant being in my consciousness now. But the way he's in my consciousness goes from being that historical figure in the body to the picture of him, like right there, to the qualities of humor, rascality, blup, you know, fierceness, all that, to this spacious present. And when I get into the deepest, emptiest, clearest, quietest, it's as if then I'm in the most intimate space with him, because we've gone beyond form and it's just, we're just sitting in it. And that's where that line came out this morning. And you say this to Guru in the lineages, you say, may your wisdom mind and my wisdom mind remain inseparable. Okay. You're working from this place of the inseparability of the source, and then the manifestations are all unique. So as that awareness comes into Ramdasness, it is unique from that historical person who's dead. As I go back into the place behind my own uniqueness, or within it, however you want to call it, because all the words fail, into just the spacious, present, clear awareness that doesn't fixate on anything, then there's only one of it. And he and I are there together. And what I'm experiencing is just watching this day occur. I'm watching this day occur. And you're appearing, and then somebody else will raise their hand, and then you can feel, it's like a dance of forms. All day long, every day, all the time. There's no way out of it anymore. Right? It used to be something I did for an hour. And see, what you do is you start out by, like, early morning, you sit for a half hour in order to try to connect to that space for a moment. And then you go out and you live life and you get lost back into the storyline. And then at the end of the day, maybe you sit in an evening before you go to bed and you see where you got lost. And you kind of go through it a little bit and then come back into the space for a moment. Then go to sleep, go into your dreams where they're really solid, come back up, sit, get back to the space, go out, get lost, right? I mean, it's sequential. And then after a while, you keep working with it until you're that space. You're just constantly coming into it and out of it, into it and out of it. And you can feel yourself in this spaciousness. And then suddenly, it's just like you put on a suit into form, like a wetsuit or something, or you dove into a medium thicker than the one you were in before. You begin to feel the thickness of life, the thickness of the stuff. And then you just do whatever you do, Ram or, and you come back and balance it again. Just this balancing process. Okay? Yeah. The use of spiritual practices for a purpose. Primarily, the way I think the kind of place that I work from is that the deeper the source connection, the deeper the emptiness, the more my acts will be appropriate to the deepest truth of the universe. so that I don't ever, it's like I don't ever tell God what to do. I don't try to manipulate the game. I just keep listening deeper and deeper into who it is I am and how the story came out. In other words, the story's all there. The question is where you're standing in relation to it, right? So the whole business of affirmations or wishes for something to be different, it's not one that I work with, because it's not, because I realize that who wants it is the lesser of the two parts of myself, in the sense that that want is coming out of the felt need, and yet the other part of me has no needs and no wants. And if I were functioning from there, I would still honor this part of me, but I wouldn't manipulate to its for its end. So, what I find is, like when you ask a question, my strategy is to empty. My strategy isn't empty to think of the answer. My strategy is to empty to not think of the answer and then let the answer emerge. That's a different place. And yet it's pragmatic and it's functional and it's aimed, but it isn't aimed, if you can hear that distinction. So you have to allow it all to be up for grabs all the time. It may well be that as I go deeper, I will see that the Guatemalan game isn't what my game's to be. I've got to risk that. If I say I'll meditate, but don't let it screw up my income, watch out. You see, that's the thing. You've got to let it all up for grabs. You've got to allow the possibility that it all may change. Otherwise, your meditation is a funny kind of using a spiritual power for a worldly end. It's a trap. Is that dealing with the question? Yes. The relationship between prayer and meditation. There are different strategies for coming into intimacy with the One that are appropriate for different people, different strokes for different folks. Now, some people can sit and face a wall and empty their mind in Zen practice and then know the fullness of the moment. Some people can't do that. Some people are very active and they can't sit. And Tai Chi is a beautiful form for them of movement as a meditative practice. For many, many people, they lead with their emotional heart. It's relational primarily, the way they live. And for those people, prayer or contemplation becomes a beautiful technique. It's as if you have a beloved and you are making love to the beloved and it's getting more and more intimate, and prayer and contemplation are like the foreplay that bring you right up to the place where the orgasm occurs, where the merging occurs. But that, so you use dualism to take you into non-dualism, right to the edge of it. So that prayer is a form of dualism, of, in a way, separating yourself from yourself to pray to yourself. I mean, it's that bizarre. And the question is, what do you ask for in prayer, which is the same question again. And all I would ever, I couldn't ask for anything. I could ask just to be aware or to hear more clearly or anything. But even that isn't, how do I know whether I'm supposed to hear more clearly? See, the funny thing is, who I think I am thinks it knows the answer, but it doesn't. Because until you sit in a place, there's a line I have from a letter I wrote to a parents of a girl who was raped and murdered. And there was one line in it I'd like to read to you if I can find the letter. I'd probably be up. It said, when something this horrible happens, it's a long letter, but it says, something in you dies when you bear the unbearable. In other words, you go beyond just the horror and the pain of it, because it just takes you beyond it, because you can't bear it. And it is only in that dark night of the soul that you're prepared to see as God sees and to love as God loves. I mean, the horrible beauty of the universe, and to realize that there is a wisdom inherent in it, and that wisdom includes suffering. And the suffering isn't an error. Until you are resting in a place that understands that, how presumptuous of you to think you know best. Like, I have watched in the work I do with people that are dying, where they suffer and they suffer and they suffer, and if I could, as a human emotional heart, I would do everything I could to take away their suffering. And it's breaking my heart that they are suffering. And then I watch that suffering burns its way to finally they give up, because the suffering is so great. And I've watched when they give up, something emerge in their being that is so beautiful and so radiant and so spiritually innocent that it's like they meet a part of their being for the first time that's been hidden all their lives. It's like an egg breaks open and I suddenly meet this being. It happened with my stepmother, Phyllis, as she was dying. We went through a period where she was in pain and willful and tough, and then it cracked. And at the moment it cracked, what came forth was somebody so radiantly beautiful that it blew her mind even. And she and I were just together in this incredible grace right to the end. Now, I looked at that with horror and with beauty. I would have taken away all that suffering if I could, because I really loved her. I didn't want her to suffer. My human part. At the same moment, when I looked at it from a spiritual point of view, it was that very suffering which forced that thing which brought her through. Now, am I to say that suffering stunk, or was it good? See, and that's the horror of the thing. The horrible beauty is that suffering is grace and suffering stinks. And until you can stand right in that balance point and see both of those, what are you going to pray for? Do you hear the predicament? Do you hear where you're praying from? You're saying, I want it different because I can't stand it the way it is. And I'm saying, once you see the way it is and just see it fully, you don't really wish to change it. You may want to understand it. See, I don't go into a scene to take away somebody's pain. I go in to be with them, and if they want to let go of their pain, that's fine. And if they don't, that's their business. I don't think I have a moral right to die somebody else's death. Am I dealing with the question? What do I think about the Big Bang Theory? I just like to use the Dalai Lama's line. He was asked the same thing. What do you think about the Big Bang? And his answer was, which one? What? Yeah, but that wasn't the first one. That's the thing, it turns out. That was just another one. It all depends on what your time frame is. And because the written history and recorded history and all this is just, and bullions and bullions of what's his name are just like a passing show from another point of view. I mean, when the Buddhists, they say, how many times have you incarnated? You know that image. Imagine the mountain 6 miles wide, 6 miles long, 6 miles high. And every 100 years, a bird flies over the mountain with a silk scarf in its beak and rubs it across the top of the mountain. And the length of time it would take the scarf to wear away the mountain, that's how long you've been doing this. See? Doesn't it give you a different perspective? See? Like, it's all so, here I am, again, and again, and again, and again, and again. Yes. Yeah. The term guru, the concept of guru, which is very little understood in the West, because it's not a teacher. A teacher points the way, and the guru is a mirror of the way. The guru is a cooked goose, really. And we don't have many of them in the West. We don't have any of them in the West that I know of. I mean, we have a lot of people that say they're gurus, but that's a whole other ballgame. But in terms of a cooked goose, it's somebody that isn't, their mind isn't caught anywhere. So when you meet them, What you see is where your mind is caught. It mirrors back your own attachments to you. I mean, with all the time I was with my guru, I couldn't find him anywhere. There was nobody there, really. There's nobody there. Now, it's wonderful to have such a person, and it's not necessary. Because each person has a different route through, and for some, after all, the guru's inside as well as outside. For some, it'll be the Christ figure. For some, it'll be the internal figure. It doesn't matter whether they're dead or alive. I mean, they can still mirror. If you get close enough to Christ consciousness, you'll see mirrored all the stuff you aren't all the time. You can use it to mea culpa yourself, or you can use it just to do purifications, either way. But a guru is lovely, but it's not necessary. It's grace, but it's not necessary. Okay? Yeah. Yes. How do I come to the choices? How do I work in this political thing with nuclear waste in New Mexico, with AIDS, with Guatemalans, with the police, with my father, etc.? How do you hear what your unique, what's called dharma, or way through is? You listen your way into the existential situation. It may be that some, like when SEVA began, the SEVA Foundation, we came together as a group of people that wanted to alleviate suffering and wanted to spiritually grow in the process. Then the question of which suffering should we alleviate? Well, we each have our own thing we'd like. But there was one very, very powerful, charismatic woman from Europe, and she said the thing to take on is blindness, because 80% of the world's blindness is preventable and curable, and we could do it. Take it on. So I thought, I don't have any brief for blindness. It's a nice thing to take on, but I mean, what about infant diarrhea, for God's sakes? I mean, more people die of infant diarrhea than blindness. But she said blindness, and everybody said, yeah, let's do blindness. So suddenly, I've spent the last 13 years working in blindness. We're building hospitals, all these cataract operations, all this. And then I realized that where you enter into the sea of suffering doesn't matter. Because you can sit around saying, which is the worst kind of suffering? Till hell freezes over. Because everybody will come up to you and say, if there's not peace, if there's not an end of nuclear, if there isn't, and you can get the list, and the list goes, and each one thinks it's the most important. And what you've got to do is listen your way in, and sometimes I'm doing something because somebody calls and asks me. And sometimes I'm doing things because I get something in the mail and something hits inside of me and I do it. I get, as you do, I'm sure, you're all on the good person mailing list. And we get this stuff by the pound, you know? I mean, it comes every day. And I realize that there's no rational way I can decide that I'm going to be for Southern justice this time, or what am I going to be, for congressional watchdog, or am I going to be, you know? And so I just open the mail, and I go through it, and some grab me at this moment, and I do it. I write the check, and some are nice things, but they don't grab me at that moment. That's where I'm learning to trust my intuitive wisdom, because you can't rationally do that. You can't rationally decide which thing to do. You intuitively do it. When you're quiet enough and intuitively tuned enough, you begin to hear the gestalt, which has to do with what the whole needs of the system are, and also what are your skills and predispositions and likes and desires. Like in the book Compassion in Action that I did with Mirabai Bush, in the list of how to go about doing it and doing, the first thing is, what do you love doing? I mean, just when you sit down, what do I love doing? Do you love being with people or not? If you love being with people, you're drawn towards something that's a people thing. If you don't, you're drawn towards something else. And you start to figure, most people, when they get into wanting to do something about suffering, somehow think they're supposed to suffer in the process. And the far-out thing is that if you suffer in the process of doing something about suffering, you are exacerbating the world's suffering. So that the way in which you relieve suffering is critical. And you have to do it when you're doing it as an exercise to awaken, then it becomes joy even when it's heavy. See, because when you're working on yourself, spirit, that's what I mean about these levels of work. I'm working with a Guatemalan widow to make her life better. That is also my spiritual practice on myself. So I may or may not be able to make her life better. The circumstances may be greater than I have power to change. Now the question is whether I'm going to be destroyed if I can't make her life better. And then you hear the whole nature of doing one's dharma. You listen, you hear your part, you do it as impeccably as you can do it, but what happens is what happens. And the secret is, do not be attached to the fruits of the action. You can want the fruits and aim towards it, but don't grab, because you don't know how it's supposed to come out. I did my best to take away Phyllis's suffering, but whether Phyllis's suffering ended or not is in God's hands. It's not in my hands. It's the same with the Guatemalan women and with the blind in Nepal, and etc. So I listen, and out of the gestalt I hear. I get lots of calls. Would you do a benefit here? Would you come here? Would you do this? Some I say, yep. Others I say, no. I don't even know why. I don't even know why. And I don't feel I have to anymore. Am I dealing with your question? Yep. I know it. And you can't do an oranges and banana thing. You can't say, well, one whale's equal to two kids, or the other way, you know. It doesn't work, because you know that some people are going to say, oh, my God, the whales, and others are going to say, oh, my God, the children, you know. And it's interesting. You've just got to listen. You've got to listen. Absolutely. I would say that Seva's work in Guatemala is doing something to counteract something that we as citizens of the United States are also doing. Okay? I hear the absolute paradox of the whole situation. Now, the question you ask is, do I do direct aid with a Guatemalan woman, or do I spend my time lobbying in Washington to get a more humane and a more conscious attitude towards Central American policy? And again, it's the same answer to that. You listen to hear your part, and you realize you're living with paradox all the time, right? I had this far-out experience. I went down, and I was blown away by the Guatemalan situation and felt incredible shame and embarrassment. I mean, it was even worse. I was in Guatemala when the army was walking through the streets, stopping us all the time. I mean, it was very scary at one level. I mean, if you get scared. And they were walking through with Uzi machine guns made in Israel, using tactics they had learned in the United States in Atlanta, Georgia. Okay. So I was getting hit both ways, as an American and as a Jew, right? And here were these Mayans whom I loved and admired. So I was at Palenque, which is a Mayan ruin in Mexico, near Chiapas. And I was sitting in the old sun temple, and I was meditating, and I said to the, I called the elders of the Mayans, and I said, your people are being really crapped upon, and I'm partly responsible. Is it, what can I do now? And what I heard was, tell your people. So I thought, well, that's far out. I mean, I'm busy with hose and water systems and stuff. Tell your people. How am I going to do that? You know, I mean, I can go and tell stories when I'm lecturing. That's what partly what I'm doing right now. But the far out thing that happened was I came, that's the time I flew to Hollywood. And when I was in Los Angeles, I got a telephone call from a man named Brian Wilson. Some of you may know. He's the guy that was run over on the railroad tracks when he was protesting that landmines were being made in the United States that were taken off the legs of people in Central America, like Mayans. And he said, we're coming up for the contra-aid vote in the Senate, and we are holding public gatherings, and would you come to the one in San Francisco and help protest against aid, against, you know. And I looked in my schedule, I said, gee, I'm awfully sorry, but I'm going to be in Washington that day. He says, well, it just happens we're having a rally in Washington that day. Would you? I said, I'd be honored. And I found myself a week after I was in that temple in Palenque on the steps of the Capitol building with a microphone telling the people about the Guatemalan situation and the widows. And I thought, wow, this really works, doesn't it? I mean, just that awesome way. And I don't know what the part is, you know? I really don't. You just hear it all. But the paradox is obvious. Yeah, absolutely.